We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development, and today is May 21st, 2013. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3479A, and we'll give a short explanation by our administrator, and while we're doing that, Representative Huffman can come on up, and I'll let you just, do you want Hennecutt to come up with you, or do you want to just?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay, come on, Dave, you can come on up, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3479A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal on the original bill, as well as no revenue and no fiscal impact on the proposed Dash 85 amendment. This bill, we have a Dash 85 amendment, which authorizes the city, it replaces the measure, and it authorizes a city to assess a charge in lieu of forming local improvement district or assess a prepayment for future lit equal to share of cost of improvements that would benefit the property, provided that it does not exceed $5,000. It's due and payable at the time and is a condition of city issuance of development or building permit, and it's kept in a dedicated fund. It's also, this particular amendment, one change is that it exempts from requirements property owners who during their two-year period prior to partition of the partition application did not reside on the property or applied for partition of another property. And then another part that it adds is that when cities are allowed to require owner to complete full improvements, they can also do it in lieu of full improvements by either paying a fee equal to the estimated costs. This amendment adds or pay a fee less than estimated costs with non-remonstrance agreement, and then they can also do it if they decide to enter a non-remonstrance agreement.
Okay. With that, you bring, Representative Huffman, you bring these kind of bills all the time. It's always exciting to have you come visit.
I'm here for you, sir.
Never a dull man.
Mr. Chair, committee, John Huffman, state rep out of the Dalles, District 59. House Bill 3479 is mine. I brought it into the body on behalf of a number of constituents in the Dalles, and understanding that it's difficult to approach a subject like this without having consequences for other communities. Early on, we brought in League of Oregon Cities and any community that contacted us that had anything to say or weigh in on the subject to make sure that we weren't doing something that was going to adversely affect those communities. The day that the bill was on the House floor, we actually had some communities reach out and said, whoa, wait, we haven't weighed in on it yet. So Mr. Hennecutt has spent the last couple of weeks working with all of those communities, and I'm not sure if the League or anybody's going to get up and testify today also, but I think Mr. Hennecutt will tell the committee that there has been extensive work with numerous communities to make sure that all of their concerns have been alleviated. I know I was in receipt of an email about 4 or 5 days ago from Dan, who represents Portland, saying that he was good with the final amendment. And so I've been in the loop on several of those emails. And so we've done our best to make sure that we're sticking to what we need to get done for the folks in the Dalles. And after Mr. Hennecutt finishes, we do actually have a few of my constituents from the Dalles that drove down to testify to tell you some of the hair-raising stories. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Hennecutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 3479 and the Dash A5 amendments. The A5 amendments are the result, as Representative Huffman indicated, of substantial work undertaken over the last 3 weeks to a month since the bill came out in its original form, with representatives of the various municipalities, the League of Oregon Cities, and the like, and the home builders as well. And I can tell you, with these amendments, we do not have opposition from the League, from the City of Beaverton, from the City of Portland, from the City of Medford. Eugene and Springfield are now okay. Every city that approached us and asked for amendments. We made amendments to the bill to address their concerns, and I think we've narrowed the bill essentially to the point where their concerns have been addressed. So what the bill deals with and what the Dash A5 amendments deal with are funding for infrastructure improvements, cities or streets and sidewalks and water and sewer and things of that nature. Under the current law, typically the way a city will finance infrastructure improvements is through either one or a combination of system development charges, which are assessed at the time of development to a developer, or on a more rare occasions through the formation of a local improvement district where there's an area, a particular area of town that is in line for special, for some type of special benefit for, derived from a particular infrastructure improvements. Let's say they want to put sidewalks in a particular area of town that doesn't currently have sidewalks. What most city ordinances will provide is that the property owners or the city can form a local improvement district, determine the properties that are specially benefited by the proposed improvements, include those properties in the district, figure out the total project cost for doing the work, and then propose a method of assessment to spread those total project costs amongst the various property owners so that everyone is paying essentially their fair share to make the improvements. In almost every city ordinance that city that has a local improvement district ordinance, there are also provisions to give the property owners who are proposed to be included and assessed the right to object, and if there are enough property owners that object, and the percentage varies from municipality to municipality, but if there are enough that object, then the district doesn't get formed. So either through the systems development charge or through the local improvement district process, there are procedures that the cities have to follow in order to justify the amount of costs, the amount of either the system development charge or the amount of the local improvement district. And in the case of an LID, the property owners, and at least in every city that I know of that has an LID ordinance, are given an opportunity to give the thumbs up or thumbs down. And if they give the thumbs down, then the district doesn't form. What the DALS is doing is something a little bit different than that. They have what's known as, they're using what's known as a fee in lieu of an LID. It's a fee that's what it says it is. It's a fee in lieu instead of the formation of a local improvement district. And the way it works is that the fee is in the DALS is charged at the time of a building permit. And the amount of the fee is significant. The lowest fee, and you'll hear from the property owners from the DALS that brought this issue, the lowest fee that we've been reported is $52,000 for a two-lot partition. Okay, this was taking one piece of property and putting it into two with a residence on one and building a new residence on the other. That was $52,000. On the high end, we have a property owner who was assessed a fee in lieu of an LID of $180,000. And we're not talking about the D.R. Horton 200-lot subdivisions here. We're talking about partitions with the creation of one, two, or three lots from property owners that reside on their properties and have resided on their properties for quite some time. So we thought that was pretty significant and really not very fair. I'd never heard of a fee in lieu of an LID being so high. Essentially, in some cases, the amount of the LID, the amount of the fee that the city wished to assess exceeded the value of the property. So needless to say, development has ground to a halt, at least in this particular area of the Dalles, because none of the property owners can afford to pay the mid-five to six-figure fees without having any right to of knowing that the fee that they pay is going to go into the formation of the streets at some point, without having any right of knowing what the district is, without having any of the procedural protections that you get in the LID ordinance. They don't get any of those. They're just asked to, they're just demanded to pay the fee, and hopefully at some point maybe the Dalles will go back and do the improvements. In fact, the Dalles won't even let them make the improvements in lieu of paying the fee. And we had one property owner who said that the amount of the cost of doing the improvements, if he could hire a contractor in the Dalles and put someone to work to make the improvements, the cost of making the improvements would be significantly lower than the amount of the fee that the Dalles was attempting to assess, but they won't let you do that. And so essentially it turns into pay us a lot of money and maybe at some point in the future we'll actually widen the streets and put in the sidewalks, or maybe we won't, we don't know. What this bill does, and it's very, the reason we've lost all opposition is because we've tailored it so narrowly that I think it should address very few situations, but it helps these folks from the Dalles. What the bill does is it puts a cap on the fee in lieu of an LID at $5,000. So if you want to, if a city wants to charge a fee in lieu of an LID, that amount is capped at $5,000. If they don't want to charge a fee in lieu of an LID, they can still charge a systems development charge. They can amend their SDC ordinance to capture the full cost of making the infrastructure improvements if they want to. They can form an LID under their LID ordinances if they want to. They can require a property owner to enter into a non-remonstrance agreement where the property owner agrees that when the LID is formed, they won't object to the formation of the local improvement district, or they can require the property owner to make the improvements themselves as a condition of getting the permit to do the to partition the property. We've narrowed this bill so that it only applies. So there are four different, actually five different ways under this bill that the city can require that the infrastructure improvements are paid for. The only one that we're limiting is the fee in lieu of the LID. And that's capped at $5,000. If you want to use one of the, city wants to use one of the other methods, fine. We've narrowed the bill based on additional concerns by a number of cities so that the bill only applies to partitions, applications for partitions, not subdivisions. So we're not, again, we're not talking about the large company that comes in for a 200-lot subdivision. We're only talking about applications here for partitions, the creation of 1 to 3 lots. And all of the area that this is a problem in is residentially zoned. So these will be the creation of 1 to 3 residential lots. And we further narrowed the bill in subsection 4 of the A5 amendments on page 2, so lines 7 through 12, to property owners who people that are going in for partition applications who have resided on their property for the last 2 years and who haven't applied for a partition on any other property. So what we're talking about here, what the line we're trying to draw is between what people would normally call a, quote, developer, unquote, versus mom and pop, the single property owner who wants to partition their property, create an additional lot that they can build a house on, sell the rest of the property so that they can help with their retirement. Those are the people we're trying to help, and with the A5 amendments, we've narrowed this bill to essentially only helping those types of people and not helping companies that want to subdivide property or companies that maybe want to just partition a piece of property but do that for a living. I don't have a problem helping them, obviously. I've done that many times over the course of the years. But in order to make sure that this bill is narrow and can meet with, hopefully, with everyone's approval, we put in some real narrowing factors in here that I think will still help the folks in the Dalles without getting everybody else worried about it. So we urge the committee to accept the A5 amendments, and we hope, really hope, that you'll move this bill along.
So with that, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Who put this policy into effect, the fee in lieu of the LID?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, the statute, the Oregon Revised Statute, contains the phrase fee in lieu of a local improvement district. So the legislature at some point in time authorized cities to charge fees in lieu of an LID, and that's so, the
so
only...
So it was the city council, pardon me for interrupting, it was the city council who did it?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, that's correct.
And when did the city council do that?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, that I believe that was in the late 2000, the latter part of the last decade. And what you'll see...
Fairly recently.
Yeah, it was fairly recently.
And how long are city council terms?
Well, Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, it's interesting you should ask. Yes, typically 4 years. But you should, you'll either be getting a packet or maybe you already have a packet with letters from property owners in the Dalles who have been impacted by this, along with an editorial from the Dalles Chronicle entitled An Unreasonable Burden to Bear. I think you know which way the editorial board at the Chronicle is going based on that title, along with a couple of articles from the Chronicle, one entitled City Council Chastised at Town Hall. That's putting it mildly. Or tar and feathers were provided. So, yes, this has proven to be quite controversial in the Dalles, but unfortunately, we've attempted to resolve there and without success.
Mr. Chair, I just had a chance to glance at some of these letters and glance at the editorial, but it's pretty clear to me that something's seriously wrong here. The question is how you solve it. I mean, this is an elected city government that has taken some statutory authority that I'm not aware of other cities abusing in this way. And it would seem to me that even though I commend you for narrowing it to the point where it probably applies only to a 3-block area. No, I'm just kidding. But so I commend you for that, but I still can't get past the fact that it's the wrong remedy to solve this problem. And furthermore, I think if we solve this problem, what else is this particular city council going to be doing that you're going to be back here next session to solve? I think the voters in the Dalles need to take a look at this situation, and they need to exert their own remedy in their own way, and that's probably through the electoral process. And did this come through a planning commission first?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, I don't believe so, because the LID statute or ordinances would not be considered land use regulations.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think these are pretty stunning letters about the impact. I can't get past the fact that these are elected officials who did it. And I know that if you and I were to do something like this, Mr. Chair, our tenure would probably be limited.
Good.
Well,
Senator Pazanski.
Senator Burdick kind of went the direction I was going to go. And I guess the one thing is I understand we're trying to fix something, but it's here at the state level that we're trying to fix a local problem. And Dave, I mean, to your credit, you've worked through a lot of exemptions and exceptions for a lot of people around the state. And my concern is if we continue to see these hodgepodge means of trying to take care of a local problem, how do we undo it? Because at some point, our statutes are going to be even that more murky as to how you go through it, where we had a choice here that statutorily was given to cities to act, or I guess maybe even counties, and they chose whatever they've done, and it sounds like they've not following up with the redress. I mean, this is pretty scaling stuff here as to what the citizens have said of how they've directly been impacted, and also looking at, let's say, the lack of response from the local leaders, even when they're taking a task in the newspapers. So I'm lukewarm at this point.
If I could make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And to Senator Burdick and Senator Przanski's concerns, and I'm not sure if the articles and the letters go, how much detail they go through, but there's been a fair-sized constituency that's been working with the city council and staff, and I don't know how many times the council has turned over, but part of them have been gone a couple of years or so since 2007, and they put together a work group. This situation is largely staff-driven. They're all good friends of mine. I've worked with them for decades in the Dalles, so it's not an easy thing that I do. But my constituents really have tried their best to work within the system, work on a work group. I think you'll hear testimony where out of the work group, recommendations were made by the city council to the staff. The product that came back in ordinance form from the staff didn't match what they were directed to do.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do the staff serve at the will of the council?
Yes.
Are these protected?
Yes, decisions? They do, Senator.
Okay, this is, yeah, I'm kind of.
And if I might say, if you look at the Dalles and the way we're in the scenic area, and so our urban growth boundary is very confined, and so a lot of the Dalles is really built out, and so it's predominantly on the east end of town where you have lot partitions available, and so when you look at, you know, voting in and out council members, frankly, most of the community is not affected by this. So most people, it's over their heads until they read something in the Dalles Chronicle about it. So it's that unique situation where it's a small group of people that are affected, and I'm here to help them.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chair, but I'm ready to go to the Dalles right now
and, exactly.
And start picketing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, I mean, Representative Huffman, I mean, maybe we should just do the whole thing here. Maybe we should just tell the Dalles they have to go to an LID. I mean, does that make it better where they then have the checks and balances for the citizens? Your constituents will actually have the redress they don't have now because they've chosen to do this charge in lieu of? I mean, if we're going to do this, let's pull the plug on it.
Right. And the other option might be, in hearing all the same thing, is that we do away with the statutory agreement that they could do in lieu of.
Right.
Take that right out of the statute. So it just leaves the other options available to people.
Right. I mean, at least in this particular case, we have a city that seems to not be responsive, and maybe what we need to do is bring them into where the citizens have more checks and balances because they're not being responsive. Whether we need to do it across the board, I would say that probably be a question I would be asking.
Right. Other cities and stuff.
Other cities in the interim type of work. But it seems to me if we're going to do these type of fixes where you have to get all these exceptions and exemptions for making sure you're not stepping on other people's toes, and we've got plenty of at least anecdotal evidence saying that this council hasn't been responsive, just direct them that they have to do it the other way where they will be more responsive.
Chair Roblund, Senator Przanski, if the committee is interested in amendments that would require the Dalles to form an LID, that'd be fine. I'm I'm afraid to do what the chair suggested and just take that statutory language out. We'd have a room full of.
That'd be a little quick.
Yeah, I think we'd find opposition to that.
Yes, I do too.
But it's that dilemma that you are all familiar with, where you have language that you can narrow to address. You know, we could address this to cities with the population in excess of 5,000 people in Wasco County, and solve the problem. But,
Mr. Chair, I come from the communications business, and when you have a situation like this, even though it's a small area, I think when you've got your newspaper involved and you've got basically a community, because I'm sure your community is just like every other community that has a basic sense of fairness, it seems to me that what you have here is a communication, don't mean to quote from a movie or anything, but a communication issue that people really need to understand what's going on here. And it seems to me that the outrage factor would be sufficient to accomplish what you want. I mean, these are elected officials. I assume there's some competition for the city council races. I assume that this is the sort of thing that could become a campaign issue. If it isn't, it should. I just see that as the pathway, you know, to...
All I would say is that we've had issues like that at the state level with Senate Bill 100, that people came up with lots of different things, and eventually it created ballot measure 49 and 37 and all those other kinds of stuff over a few of this kind of incident. I mean, that's exactly where that came from, actually, when you look at it. And so I have always felt that we should try to resolve them before they get to the part where you have to have the total result.
Well, no, but I think it's appropriate to have them be an electoral issue at the local level.
Oh, I agree.
Because I've not heard, this is a new issue to me, I've not heard of this particular statutory provision causing a problem anywhere else in Oregon. That doesn't mean it hasn't, but I haven't heard of any. And if a city is taking a statutory tool and way overreaching, which is what it sounds like to me, it seems like that's an issue that the local people need to address through the electoral process.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have dealt with this lid issue in my district when I served in the House. And, gentlemen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the problem I see with these lids that this in lieu of could help with is when you have the elderly. In my district, it hit the elderly really hard because they've been there for decades. They bought their property pretty cheaply. They had large pieces of property along the road, and so their assessments in the lid for the road widening was $25,000. And two of them were widows in their 80s. And so when we protested, the response of the city council was, well, why can't they take out a loan? Well, they're 85 years old, you know, and that didn't matter to the leaders. So what I see here with this language in statute is that at least gives people, when they're younger, the option of prepaying so that if it does come up later and the costs go up, they might have a little more opportunity to stay on their land, or at least not go into debt. Because the way they had drawn, at least in our district, they had drawn, you know, the road improvements were the Cadillac, not the Chevrolet. You know, they had very wide fire lanes. They had tall sidewalks. And so it was very expensive, very much more expensive than the way they used to do the roads. So can you comment on that? Have you had instances where the seniors are especially affected with the lids?
Chair Roblin, Senator Close, I think you'll find from the witnesses that that's exactly the problem that we're having here. The folks that are impacted by this fee in lieu of the LID are elderly folks, and the amount of the fee in some cases exceeds the value of the property. If an LID was formed, then by ordinance, the property owners in the district wouldn't, number one, know that they were in the district and be notified, number two, know what the total project costs for the work was going to be, and number three, know that there's a proposal to spread those assessments and know how much the assessments were going to be so that they could make an informed decision about whether or not they wanted to belong to the district, and then they could have a vote. We don't get that in this situation when a fee is charged in lieu of the LID. You don't get that opportunity, and so that's what we're trying to fix.
But if you follow, if you capped it, then it would make that more a more attractive alternative, wouldn't it?
Exactly, which is what that's what we're proposing to do here is cap these fees in lieu of LIDs at, in this case, $5,000.
And I guess my other question is, there is no requirement when they charge the fee that it not just go in the general fund and they use it for general expenses right now and never build the roads or do anything, correct?
Chair Roland, that's correct. And the other, which is the other important thing that this bill does, is it directs that if a city charges a fee in lieu of an LID, that they have to keep that money in a fund that's dedicated to the purpose for which the charge or prepayment was assessed, so that that would ensure that whatever you pay goes into a fund so that when the work, if the work or when the work is done, that money is available to do the work and not just dumped into the general fund.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It does sound like, I mean, if we really wanted to go with LID, we could actually put this to a, in statute where it'd be a population of 5,000 or greater for Wasco County. I mean, we've done this with other communities that were out of touch with reality, where they were, let's say, doing revenue building.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Quarter of a million plus. and so it could be done that way.
That's true. And it wouldn't make it so much the statute. It would just be that little exception.
If we did that, then I guess the question for Dave would be, you actually, at that point, they would have to establish these districts, and it would allow the individuals that are here and others that could be potentially impacted to determine whether or not they want to be part of that district. And so they could actually have that check and balance on the front end.
Correct.
Knowing exactly what they're going into. And it may get word out that they need, the city officials need to be a little bit more responsive than they've been to their community. I'm really concerned, I mean, without having this other stuff, I mean, that's the whole thing. We keep on looking, okay, how can they get around it? We know right now they can put the funds into a general fund.
Right.
but we're going to put something in there to narrow that to make certain it goes to an exclusive dedicated fund that may be used, may not be used.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
We'll probably be getting back to you on this one, Dave.
Well, that'd be fine.
Okay. Actually, that's a simpler way. With that,
it sends a message too,
and it does send a clear message, which might be necessary. John Denny, Gary Denny, and Randy Hager. Anyone who wants to start, and don't forget to say who you are at the beginning so that we have it for the record.
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Denny. I live at 2651 East 10th Street in the Dalles, Oregon. We purchased our property in the city of the Dalles with the idea that we would be able to divide the large lot at some later point in time and place a one-level home on the second lot upon retirement. Now, when it is necessary for us to divide the large lot, the city is requiring us to pay approximately $52,111 into a fund for future streets, sidewalks, curbs, and storm drains, with no guarantee that those improvements will be done in our lifetime. The city, at the time of this quote, is charging at the rate of $351 per linear foot for this work, which is outrageous. This fee does not include filing, surveyor, or other costs to us while trying to divide the lot. We are ready to downsize. The house on our lot has become more than we wish to take care of. Besides being two levels and having to climb up and down stairs to access storage and living spaces, we are finding that because of the recession, our retirement fund is running out faster than anticipated, causing unneeded stress. We tried selling the whole parcel almost 4 years ago, and there were no takers. Our real estate agent thought it might sell better if we did a minor partition and were able to lower the price of the house and the upper lot, on the upper lot. So we surveyed the land, and the survey could not be recorded until we paid into the fund. Since then, we have been trying to have the ordinance changed, but have not succeeded. We just want to divide our lot and sell the upper parcel with the house on it, not give the city money for something we will not see any benefit from. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is John Denny, and I live at 2651 East 10th Street in the Dalles, Oregon. Due to changes in passage in the city of the Dalles of ordinances and resolutions in the past several years, the ability to simply divide a piece of property for the purpose of selling or passing portions on to relatives has become impossible without incurring a huge debt for the landowner. Even a minor partition, which requires a survey to be done, also requires that you either pay into a local improvement fund the complete cost of installing streets, gutters, and sidewalks, and have it done yourself. But you cannot do the work yourself if the city hasn't engineered all parts of the infill along the street, which, of course, they have not. Therefore, the only way you can divide a partition, divide or partition your land is to pay into the fund, because the city won't let you record your partition without paying into the fund. The city wants us to pay over $52,000 into the fund just to partition the land into two parcels, and then the improvements may not happen in our lifetime. We know that issues aren't resolved overnight, but some of the citizens that are caught in this debacle, time is running out. We need action and resolve for the citizens of the Dalles. We need the committee to help us obtain a fair and equitable solution for the property owners of the city of the Dalles. We would like the committee to pass this bill, which would enable us to decide when we are ready to sell our property and which portion to sell without being pressured by the city to pay into a fund or provide the infill just to survey our land and divide it. Thank you for your time and attention to our problem.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Randy Hager. I live at 2804 East 10th Street in the Dalles, a property that I bought in 2002, which at the time I purchased it had the written right to divide into three lots with total development charges for sewer and water and service development charges for three lots amounting to $8,200. I've been told by our city staff that I no longer can divide my property unless I pay approximately $80,000 into a city fund, which is described as a future local improvement district. I have two bids from local contractors that specified to me that I could have the work done for approximately $21,000 to $23,000. However, the city will not allow me to do that work at this time at that cost, because they don't have the engineering done. They would demand that I pay the $80,000 into a fund and never see the work happen. I understand House Bill 3479 will give me the statutory protection that's not currently available to me. Over the last 7 years that the Dalles City staff has been attempting to implement a broad-reaching and insurmountable plan, I've become a kind of listener to folks who have these large lots like mine. Some that have a frontage, street frontage that exceeds 200 feet. And in some cases, large tracts still exist as commercial cherry orchards. What I'm seeing is that it has become impossible for me, in consideration that I was prepared to, I had finished the house, rebuilding the house that was on the lot when I bought it, and I was prepared to sell that lot in 2007 and I started hearing that these fees were going to be charged to me if I decided to divide off a lot or sell the property. So at this point, I feel like I'm sitting on a piece of property that I've completed and is prepared for sale for a family to live in, and I would be assessed $80,000 if I want to sell the property or divide it off. I think you'll see in possibly a demonstration today that the city's manner of writing this ordinance that they want us to live by exceeds everything that any one of us imagines would be the proper thing for us to live with. So I hope you take deep consideration of the relationship between the people that live in the city of the Dells that are facing these high assessments and the manner that the city of the Dells wants to implement them. Thanks a lot, you guys. I think you've heard us today, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions for this panel? Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for coming over here.
Thanks, you guys.
Yes. Chair. One question.
I would like to follow up on how your interactions with the city council have been, because that's clearly, you know, where the policy is set on this. Have you met with them? Did this come up in their elections?
Senator Boroblin, about 7 years ago, we decided that we were going to divide our property. Well, I took out a minor partition just about 4 years ago, and I could not complete the task without paying into the fund. And at that time, I cannot, and I don't think too many other people could afford $51,000 or $52,000 just to divide my land. And so I started the process of going from the planning department to the city manager to the council people and so on until I got to the point that we went to a number of council meetings, and what came back from what council had indicated that how the ordinance should be read, it did not meet the quality that would give us any relief, actual relief, because we end up having to have either an attachment to our property in the property file and have a non-remonstrance where the future, if we sold the property, would not be able to remonstrate against an LID if they tried to form one. So we've, for the last, like I say, since about 2006, 2007, we have been trying to work on this process, and we are now at what we consider the last step. And as Randy has said, that we need help in having it happen, because I don't think we're going to be able to do it in the city itself.
Thank you.
Yes,
Senator Krasinski.
I think I do want to follow up on the question that's there, and also knowing that you were going to be required to pay before you could even start this process. Mm-hmm. And it may be a question that Mr. Honeycutt may need to come back, but if we actually had this fund set up that was going to be dedicated, what I heard the testimony was that there's no guarantee, one, it's ever going to occur. And that also seems like it puts everyone or keeps everyone in stalemate, because until they do that work, I'm assuming they're not going to let you start partitioning or dividing the land, because it seems like it's all tied together.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brozak, mm-hmm. Senator Roblin, that's actually the case, is that we can't do anything until we get the land divided. And in order to divide the land, we have to pay the money.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to have to zip over and testify on a bill in another committee, so I'm going to leave my vice chair in charge for the next part. So we have...
You live dangerously.
It shouldn't take me long. I'll be right back.
Talk quick.
Yes, I'll talk quick.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so where are we at here? We're Mr. Garrett and anybody else? We'll wait for them, okay. Thank you for coming to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Garrett Krosick. I'm here on behalf of the City of the Dalles. And I wanted to start off by saying that the goal of the City of the Dalles is to promote economic development and economic growth and development, particularly these, what we're calling in our community, infill development. So when we identify a barrier, we do actively work to remove that barrier so we can facilitate development. That's not to say that all of our policies have proved effective, but we do seek to address them when it becomes clear that they are no longer working. That's what occurred prior to the introduction of this legislation, and that is what would have occurred had this legislation never been introduced. Now, that said, we do have issues with this legislation that lead us to take the position that the legislation is not beneficial for either developers or cities trying to manage development, and we ask that this committee either not support this legislation or consider several of the amendments that we proposed, which were mailed in the agenda packet, and I just distributed hard copies as well. The city does not support this legislation for three reasons. On a philosophical level, assigning responsibilities for street improvements is a local issue, and we feel that this legislation intrudes upon this local policy sphere. Second, the cost of residential partitions, which is the central issue to this legislation, which you just heard testimony on, we've already developed a local we are in the process of developing a local solution to that issue, which is also what we have proposed is also in your materials. Third, if the legislation was as precise as it's being conveyed to you, we would support it, but we feel it does a lot more and creates a lot more questions than it does answers, and for that reasons, we're not supporting the legislation. So you've heard a lot about how things are in the Dalles, and I want to give some background because it doesn't make sense out of context the way it was presented to you guys. Prior to 2007, the way development worked in the Dalles was that property owners would sign a non-remonstrance agreement and pursue their development. This created problems, particularly as properties changed hands, as the new owners who came into these non-remonstrance agreements realized what that meant and that they couldn't afford the LID, just as Senator Close identified. And what ended up happening was that a citizen task force was assembled, and they came to the conclusion that we really shouldn't be passing what are local improvements, which is different than a system development charge. System development charge is how you deal with accommodating the 101 user on a system that only supports 100 users. Local improvements are those improvements that need to be put in order to accommodate the development that's proposed. That is a street, a sidewalk, a sewer, stormwater. So the citizen task force said, the people that are actually being affected by these non-remonstrance agreements are not the people that are in the best position to pay for them. What we should do is move that as far ahead of the line as possible so that it's the developer that's contemplating these local improvement fees when they make the decision whether or not to develop. So that's where these what we call uniform rates, the $300 that you've heard quoted earlier, where those came in. The problem that we have is that large areas of our community do not have approved engineering designs in place. And we can't allow property owners to put in their own improvements without engineering designs in place, because otherwise the pipes don't line up, the streets don't. It's a bad situation. And the way that the city has been able to pay for engineering has been through the LID districts. And since we haven't been successful in getting LID local improvement districts put together, we had to go another route. And the way we did that was with, which is as is allowed in state statute, we went with the payments in lieu. How we calculated those, we looked at our past couple of jobs and took some averages, and these, again, are in 2007. These numbers haven't changed since 2007. Now, the number that you heard, the $350-some-odd dollars per linear foot, that's a breakdown. That's broken down as follows. Streets are, that would be the street and the sidewalk component of that. That's $176 per linear foot. The storm water, that's about $60 per linear foot. Sanitary sewer, that's about $65 per foot. And water distribution, that's about $51 per foot. We charge based on what the property is missing. If all they're missing is the sidewalk or the street, that's all they're being charged for. It's not a uniform $351 per linear foot for every given property. And I might also point out that we are not the only community that has taken this approach. Just down the road, Madras, they also charge payment with in lieu, and our rates are comparable. They charge about $174 for streets. We charge $176. We think that's pretty good, considering they're a much flatter area with a lot less basalt to work with. Now, of course, the problem with charging those fees at the earliest point is that it creates a large upfront cost to development, which is particularly burdensome if you have a large lot. And that is where we're seeing the largest issues being raised, is those large lot owners on the peripheries of town. So to address that, starting since last September, we've had two work sessions dedicated solely to this residential partition issue. We've also, it's come up at least one, I believe, two city council meetings as discussion items, and we recently had a town hall. So there has been a lot of process and citizen engagement. And our councillors have been aware of this issue and responsive, but it's a complex issue. You need to balance not only the current property owners, but the future property owners, as I identified earlier, with the city's interest in health and safety that go hand in hand with the installation of local improvements. So what you're seeing on the board here is basically the is a guide for the land use and development ordinance amendments that we proposed. As you see there, someone who's just trying to do a residential partition under our proposal would be able to complete that without making any of those payments. What they would do instead is sign a non-remonstrance agreement, which is payable at the time that they apply for a subsequent building permit. That's actually the language that this legislation eventually got to. So we're not sure. We're seeing some redundancy there. So all we've done is we've moved it to the vertical development stage of development instead of the partition stage. So that addresses that concern. Could residential property owners get through a partition without making the outlays? Yes, under our proposal, which had already gone through Planning Commission at the local level and was going to be introduced at City Council until we stopped because of the introduction of this legislation, as we didn't know where it was going to lead. And as I mentioned earlier, if this legislation did precisely what our land use and development ordinance amendments proposed to do, we'd be on board, and we wouldn't have driven the 100 miles to talk to you here today. But we believe it goes a little bit further than that. Specifically, it establishes those limitations on what you can do at the partition stage to not only residential development. There's no qualification here for commercial and industrial partitions, and we don't feel it's appropriate to put those restrictions to release those limitations on what you can require for a partition to both commercial and industrial properties. There's also a lot of confusion. After we've gone through this three times, had it reviewed by our city attorney, we are not sure what are the rules for not only the residential versus the industrial types of partitions, but we're not clear what the rules are going from the partition stage to the vertical development stage. And we're also seeing some internal inconsistencies with this residency requirement, but also that even if they don't qualify as a resident, you still can only do the fee in lieu of payments if the property owners agree. We just feel that this extra language beyond what we've proposed in our land use and development ordinance is going to create confusion. We're nervous it's going to create litigation in our interpretation of these provisions, and it's for those reasons that we do not support this legislation. So with that, I am happy to take any questions.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Garrett is your name?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Garrett, the gentleman that testified that his fee that he was told he would have to pay would be $80,000. What is he getting for $80,000?
I can't speak to that because I wasn't the one that quoted him that figure. What he would be getting would depend on what his property is missing. If he has absolutely nothing there, then he would be the $350 per however many feet of frontage his property had. And that would include everything: street, storm, sanitary, and water.
Yes, Paul.
You know, to put in perspective, to build a house right now, it's about $120 a square foot, and you're giving them an estimate of $350 a lineal foot. Pretty soon, you're going to add so much to the cost of that house that they cannot sell it for that amount. That's a problem for your community, because people aren't going to come in and buy an old house that's $300,000. Because you're adding so much to the cost of their property, now they can't sell it for what they've got into it, and they're forced to do that. So if that was me, I'd go, well, you know, let's sell and get out of here to avoid this. I don't think you want that outcome.
We, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Close, we don't assess fees until there's been some type of development.
Well,
so if you have an existing,
$80,000, though.
We have not assessed anything until
they gave them that quote, correct?
I can't speak to if we gave him that quote or no. I did not provide him that quote. He may have done the calculations. He may have come in and talked to one of our planning staff, and maybe that's where the quote came from. I can't speak to that.
Okay. I'd just like you to get back to me and tell me how much of that $350 a lineal foot is the cost of the engineering, because I'd like to know what the engineers are being paid per hour to come up with this plan, and I don't know if that's part of that cost per lineal foot.
Yes, the engineering
is charges.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Close, the engineering is 10% of that total assessment, and I need to get back to your previous question. If you have a house and you're just trying to sell it, There's no assessment. If you have that house and you have a lot of extra space and you try to partition it, again, under our land use and development ordinance, you would not be assessed anything. If you tried to build that house on that vacant lot, that is when you will start running into the assessments. And I need to speak. Not only are we currently investigating or trying to move on this residential partition issue, we're also trying to investigate ways to get around this conundrum, this chicken and egg problem that we're having with the engineering needing to be in place before private property owners can put it in themselves, and the fact that the city can't pay for the engineering until we get money from the property owners. One potential solution is a reimbursement district. We're currently looking at that, because believe me, if we can get out of the LID business, which I believe the city would prefer to do, you can get cheaper price in the market because we don't do prevailing wage, and that's a state requirement. That's not the city that is driving up the prices that way. And secondly, when people go and get the private quotes, they often do not take into account the engineering. Well, they'll get a quote from a contractor, and that contractor will give them a quote, and then the contractor comes to the city and says, where's the engineering? So that leads to some of that disparity there.
Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Garrett, I'm sorry. I know you said you were at the City of Dallas. What's your capacity at the city?
At the City of Dallas, I work, Mr. Chair, Senator Pruszynski, I work in the city manager's office. I do any special projects, policy research, anything that comes up, and this has been my major assignment projects. Of the past year, yes.
I can understand that. So going through what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like the city, or at least the city manager, is trying to be responsive to some point, because some of these proposed changes have been somewhat in the works. What caught me off guard was that the city stopped the process of reform, waiting to see what we do, instead of, from my perspective, keeping that go forward so you could show the good faith and be able to come to us and say, here's what we've done and where we're going, as compared to coming, and I have not seen the packet, but it sounds like you're now working to amend whatever is before us with new amendments that the city would want. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Pruszynski, pretty close. What we have continued to move through. We held our town hall meeting, which led to that headline, City Council receives. We held that after the introduction of this bill. The only thing we have done, it made it through Planning Commission, and then what we saw was three or four quick amendments to this legislation, and that's what gave us a little pause that we should maybe, we had gone to the Planning Commission with our proposed changes. The next step would have been approval by our City Council. So all we did was push it back. We were going to introduce it in May. We were going to put it on the June, one of the two June meetings, sort of regardless of what happens here. But we felt if we waited till at least June, we'd have a better sense of what was coming out there. So in effect, it did delay it by about 2 months, a month.
Okay, if I can follow up.
Sure.
So we've heard from some of the residents that right now they are under the impression, at least, that they can't really do anything without putting money forward. And what I thought I heard you saying, and maybe this is the proposed changes as compared to what the current law is. So right now, if one of these individuals wanted to go forward, do they have to put the whatever amount of money it is that they've been assessed into the city, or can they actually sell their property right now if they wanted to sell the property without doing any of these improvements or going forward?
Mr. Vescher, Senator Pruszynski, two-part response. The first, if they just wanted to sell what's in place right now, they could do that. Nothing would be triggered. They have a disclosure issue that they would need to address to the subsequent buyer, but that's getting off in the weeds. If
what would the disclosure be that
there is a potential assessment associated with this property?
And the assessment is, I mean, see, this is what I'm trying to figure out. If I own the property, I just want to sell it. I don't want to partition it. Even though I was thinking about doing that, it seems to me that I could just sell it to whoever was a willing buyer, and then if they want it to partition it as compared to getting some notice that there's an assessment. I mean, is there already an assessment assessed just because they're selling? At some point, someone's going to have to pay to make the money be available for the engineering, et cetera?
We have not assessed in the true sense of the term any property at this point. These are, by their name, a payment in lieu of a assessment that would occur with an LID. What we have done is we have set these uniform rates so that people know what to expect when they get into a development scenario or the acquisition of a property that may require development. And we've identified those design requirements on specific streets so that if you see that you're on this street and it's missing that sidewalk or the street is clearly just not up to city standards because some of our streets are crumbling, then what you should do as a buyer would be to come into the planning department and say what is going on with this property, and you could determine it there. So no, nobody's been assessed. It's just that those assessment formulas are out there to provide notice.
One last question, if I should. So regarding the fund, now we've heard that under the LID, it would require the money to be into a separate account that would be dedicated for the work that needs to be done. And what I understand from the assessed charge in lieu of the LID, there is no requirement for that money to be set aside, that it could go into any account. Can you just tell us what the city manager's position is? I mean, is at this point, if someone was going to pay, where's that money going? Is it going into a specific account for that specific purpose, or is it just there in the general fund that could potentially be diverted to something else?
When money comes in, it goes into our special assessment fund, which is where money for any other kind of assessment goes, and we track it with property X put in this much. If an LID is formed, then they would be credited for that, just as the language says. We already do that. In fact, we do it a little bit better. We give inflation protection for people who prepay. If your assessment, the actual assessment comes in above what that fee is, you don't pay any more. But getting back to the management, yes, it sits there in that special assessment fund, and that's what it does. We do object to creating a special assessment fund, which we think we may be obligated to under this legislation, but that's how it currently operates.
One clarification on this special, Mr. Chair, if I can have a clarification.
Yes, please.
So into the special assessment fund that the city has now, can that money be diverted out of the special assessment fund and used in other purposes, or does it stick there for the intended purpose? I understand you may have two special assessments going into one bank account.
Right.
I just want to know.
No, there's not a prohibition on using what is in there for other purposes. And our practice would be that it would only be for other projects that could be used in the special assessment fund, not to fund the library or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Baker.
Has the city council been working on any kind of resolution? I mean, when somebody starts bringing these local issues to us, I think that would really trigger a response out of the city council. I'm sure the city council would like to resolve these problems more than the state legislature.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes, the city has been active in this issue. We've had, as I mentioned at the outset, we've had two work sessions dedicated solely to residential partition issue. We've also had that town hall meeting, and as well as it's come up on regular scheduled agendas. So this was the process that how it came about was property owners expressed dissatisfaction with our current system. Our city council directed staff to start investigating this. That is what led to the two work sessions, this proposed amendment, and the subsequent town hall meeting, and further investigations in how do we deal with this engineering issue as well.
Any other questions for this? None. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned to some of our committee members, and hopefully you had a chance to get around and talk to you, we had another possibility this time of session when bills are hard to find and relating clauses can create other kinds of opportunities. I'm going to invite Mike Dewey and Craig Honeyman, come on up, to talk a little bit about another thing that could fit on this same policy. Or the same relating clause.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. What I'm providing to you is an amendment that we had prepared in concert with the League of Oregon Cities and Mr. Honeyman. You also have a fact sheet on House Bill 2455. And then from Comcast, this is a nice graph I'll talk about in a minute. And this is coming to you. Representing both small and large cable companies, such as Wave Broadband, Charter Communications, Cable One, Crestview, very small cable company, Comcast, and others. And as you may or may not know, these are companies that are in the telephone business. And they compete with Integra, other what we call CLEX, competitive local exchange carriers. And we also compete with the legacy or the what we call in the vernacular the incumbent telephone companies today, a Frontier, a CenturyLink, some of the small carriers in rural Oregon that have been there from the beginning of telephone service. What we're talking about in this amendment is amending a 1989 law. And let me read the policy first in terms of this statute that would be repealing. It says, establishing a uniform base for municipal charges for street use by telecommunications carriers, in other words, telephone companies. But this statute does not refer to the competitive carriers, the companies that I represent, and others. And in 1989, and bless their heart, the incumbent carriers went to the legislature and said, notwithstanding the use of the right-of-way that's governed by the city's municipalities, we think there needs to be a limitation. And I've been representing cable companies since 1975, so I was in the room, but we didn't have a dog in that discussion because we were not in the telephone business. We were not in the data business, the internet business. We were solely in the video business. So we flash forward to 2013, and just prior to that, Comcast in the city of Eugene won a bid, which was a cell phone backhaul bid, very substantial. And the city of Eugene came to Comcast and said, we would like 5% of your revenues from this particular contract. And prior to that, the incumbent telephone company that had the business prior to that, because of the statute, didn't pay anything because it was not local dial tone. So the statute that we are repealing, suggesting in this amendment to you today, and Mr. Vice Chair, this is the opportunity we get late in the session to look for relating clauses, and we appreciate, Mr. Chair, the opportunity to have this discussion. Senator Burdick deals with revenue and telecom, and so she has the best sense of how this works. But the statute the local incumbents have sets a limitation of 7% of local dial tone or local access. So that is 7% of on a residential bill between $18 and $25. And all of the other revenues for the local exchange carrier, the incumbent, those revenues are not taxed. So we come along, we're not subject to this statute, and usually we're, if there is such a program in a city, it's 5%, and that's a default in the statute if you can't reach a franchise. So 5% of our revenues, all of our revenues on the telephone side are taxed, and for the incumbent, it's 7% of a smaller number. And I think this gives you a good reflection of what's included in the 5% for my client and 7% for the incumbent. So it's like Senator Prozanski, if I were practicing law in 1989 and you come along a little bit later, I get a better deal in terms of the tax rate that affects me. We're in the same business. We're providing the same service. So what we're doing is repealing that statute. And we had a decision as to whether or not to come down to the 7%. When I say come down from the 5% to the 7%, that's a decrease. Quite frankly, we didn't think in this body that that was going to happen. So what we thought would be fair, and Mr. Honeycutt will talk about how this works at the local level, is to allow the city to figure out what the proper rate would be and at least have everybody be equal. So for Comcast now, just on the cell backhaul, I mean, that is a $4 to $5 million business for them. At 5%, $200,000, $250,000 in taxes that isn't reflected to the other companies. Now, I like these folks, and we gave them a heads up about this particular opportunity, this discussion today, and they're in the room, and they'll talk to the public policy. This is why it's important. The business on the residential side, and you'll probably hear this from the incumbents, it's literally a zero-sum game. Most of the young folks, my son and daughter, my son lives in D.C., with his wife, they do not have a landline. My daughter and her family in Arizona, they don't. It's all cell. So it really wouldn't make any difference if our business service opportunities were not growing, but they are. And so when we talk about the business side, in my business, small business, I pay significantly in telephone services because I've got a lot of add-ons. And I'm not paying at the 7%, I'm paying at the 5%. And when you take the cloud computing, and telephone services is within that, Metro E, which would be a, for example, Comcast or Charter would have in a community. It is a telecom network, enterprise system with telephone and advanced telephone services. These are big numbers. And we need to change how we deal with a statute that no longer reflects how competition works. Because we had some discussions in the House Revenue Committee, I'll just say a few things about what others might say about this. We are in rural Oregon, the companies that I represent, paying on this particular tax. We provide telephone service. And somebody might say, well, this is going to hurt the rural telephone companies. They do have what we call universal service fund funding from both the state and the FCC, the federal fund, which we don't get, albeit we can compete. You might hear that We're not bringing wireless into this, and we don't mind having that conversation about wireless. But this is a bill dealing with the right-of-ways, and cities can already do that. So we wanted to fix this. Perhaps there's a discussion later, but we thought this statute needed something to be looked at first. Previously, somebody said, and this is inside baseball, well, the companies we're talking about are not subject to central assessment, and incumbents are, and we are subject to central assessment, clearly on the telephone side, because that's what central assessment is all about. The other thing we did in this bill, and we thought it was something pretty good, is we put a an effective date of July 1, 2014. We heard from the opposition, and they said there might be some unintended consequences. And if there were, we would have the opportunity in February of next year to fix those. So that's why we delayed the effective date of this particular bill. So we've worked with the cities. We worked with the PUC on an amendment to make sure that they were copacetic with this. So recognizing how competition has changed in the telecom market, the 1989 law needs to be fixed. And we'd like to continue, Mr. Chair and others, to have that conversation with you. Thank you, and however you want to handle this.
Okay. We'll hear your first, and then we'll have questions.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Craig Honeyman. We're with the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state. First of all, comment. If you were in those conversations as early as long ago as 1975, you must be older than you look.
Much older.
Anyway, in all seriousness, happy to be here to have the opportunity to talk about this proposed amendment to House Bill 3479. And to tell you at the outset that cities are universally supportive of the proposal which we are bringing forth. There are really two city principles in play here, one of which relates to some of the discussions you've had about the original bill, and that is the issue of home rule authority and the city's objections to any kind of preemption over the way it manages its city. It also, another principle involved is the city's right, indeed its obligation to manage its public rights of way and to be compensated for private sector use of that resource. In addition, the League generally supports the notion of fair competition between telecom providers and tax and fee policies which are technology neutral. So I'd like to suggest to you that this proposal accomplishes all of those objectives. And while telecom on its surface, especially in the areas of legislation, regulation, indeed even at times litigation, can seem to be very complex. This bill and the issue that Mr. Dewey addressed and the issue we're trying to fix is fairly simple. It removes the preemption that was created by ORS 221.515 that creates caps on franchise fees of 7% that cities can charge incumbent phone companies, as Mr. Dewey indicated, and restricts the revenue basis to old or original technology, if you will, the dial tone. Times have changed, and this statute, originally passed in 1989, is out of date. The industry has been deregulated. Technology has expanded, and the diverse array of products and services offered by these phone companies has grown significantly. But cities are still restricted to charging fees only on the basis of the original service provided, and that is, again, the dial tone. If you allow me to mix a metaphor for a moment, I also work on transportation issues. Other colleagues of yours and other committees are dealing with the same issue when it comes to the gas tax. Technology, times, the economy has changed, and we need to replace a venerable but declining source of revenue to support our highway trust fund. I would suggest to you there are similar dynamics in play here. So let me close with one critical point. This bill, this proposal, does not in and of itself raise franchise fees. It will be left, it merely would apply the rules equally to all telephone companies, all service providers across the board. The same for the ILEX, the incumbent phone companies, as for the competitive providers. Cities would still be required to enter into negotiations or pass ordinances to apply these new provisions in the proposal before you. So in sum, this bill addresses the issues of fairness and equity. It recognizes the change in technology that has rendered ORS 221.515, in our opinion, obsolete and out of date, and protects the city authority to negotiate reasonable franchise agreements with service providers within its jurisdiction. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Any questions for this? Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, first of all, this issue is pending in the House Revenue Committee, and I'm interested in it in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. So I am very interested in the issue, but I had a question. The preemption applies to, you know, both the types of service covered and the maximum fee. If we were to repeal it, is there any particular objection to setting some kind of a ceiling on the fee?
Well, Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, I guess that discussion would fall under one of the first principles that I articulated, and that's our concern about any preemption, in this case, any cap. I'd like to think that you trust cities to negotiate in good faith, knowing that it's a business deal, that having solid telecommunication services, no matter who the provider is important to that city, and would not do anything to unfairly, or unnecessarily impact that. But to answer your question, we would probably be concerned about any kind of rate cap, which is why we're so interested in this particular proposal, which does away with the 7% rate cap that currently exists on ILEX.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Yeah. Greatly appreciate it.
And we do have testimony from Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and our association is made up of all the incumbent local exchange carriers. Those are telephone companies. We do not represent wireless companies or cable companies or satellite providers of telecommunication services. Much of what the previous witnesses said is absolutely true, and we don't disagree with any of it. There is a lack of parity in some parts of the statute. We have a 7% cap on our local dial tone, as Mike indicated. There is no cap for cable providers on those kinds of same services. There is a 5% cap on their video service. In our opinion, completely eliminating the existing franchise statute is bad public policy. That cap is there for a reason. We support keeping it the way it is. The pieces of the franchise fee statute that would be eliminated would include our ability to, in our opinion anyway, and this is an open question, I think, to pass the fee through onto our customers. Cable companies can pass their fee through onto their customers unencumbered, no questions asked. We cannot do that. We are regulated companies, and the Public Utility Commission of Oregon tells us how much we can pass on and how much we cannot pass on and the manner in which that is done. That's an issue that's not been resolved in this conversation on the House side. As Mike said, this is a highly competitive industry. There's no doubt about it. There are basically four segments of this business. There's the traditional phone companies, that's us, the cable companies, wireless, and satellite providers. You will note that there is only one segment of that industry opposed to this measure, and that's us. I would submit to you that's because this advantages one over the other. We believe any effort to look at, review, renew, update needs to be exactly that. It shouldn't be the elimination of one part of the statute that gets at just one segment, and that's us. For example, long-haul providers of data. These are folks that deploy miles and miles and miles of fiber throughout many cities, and they pay no franchise fee to the city. And that's, you know, competitive disadvantage for all of us. And that needs to be addressed. As I understand it, franchise fees to many cities can be the second largest source of revenue to these cities. It's a general fund issue. These fees originally were supposed to go to manage the right-of-way and all the people in the right-of-way. We're happy to pay that. We think that's a reasonable thing to do. It's a cost of doing business. We're happy to do it. Anymore, this is a fee that's used for, I mean, whatever general fund issue needs to be funded. And in our opinion, that's really what this is about. It's not, a parity is one side issue, but as you heard Mr. Honeyman indicate, they're not interested in a cap on what they can charge my members. I believe they're interested in more revenue, which is fine. I have no problem with that, but that's what this is. We believe, and we've committed to members on the House side and to others who are willing to listen, that we, the folks with facilities in the right-of-way, can get at this issue, update this statute, and come back to the legislature with a bill that has an amount of gross retail revenue in it. With, it would have a cap, but it would be a smaller cap on a larger pool of funds. We think we can do that. We're happy to do that, and we'll do it. It was pointed out earlier, but I think it's worth repeating and maybe clarifying. The landline telecommunications business is a declining business. Folks are migrating to wireless. Lots of folks, they don't have a wireline phone. They never have, and they never will. It makes little sense in my mind, and I think it's bad public policy to shift a larger burden onto a decreasing base. It just, that doesn't even make sense to me. I don't know why the proponents of the bill would want to do that. I would think a broader conversation is more appropriate. And I'll leave that at that. I think there's lots of things to talk about here, and I appreciate the proponents of the bill giving me the heads up they were going to be here to talk about this. I don't have colored handouts to give to you, but I can tell you I asked my members who have competitors in their exchanges. Cambie Telecom competes with Wave Broadband in the city of Cambie. The franchise fee that Cambie Telecom pays to the city of Cambie is about $15,000 per quarter. What they pay, what Wave pays to the city of Cambie is about $800 per quarter. Obviously, some of that is because Cambie is a larger business. However, Wave Broadband can attribute some of their revenues to different things that are not assessed a franchise fee. This is a VoIP provider, and there's no way of determining whether it's a VoIP, you know, telephone replacement issue, or it's data, or what have you. There's no way to determine with any accuracy what they're paying their franchise fee on. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. That's just a fact, and that's a concern of ours. I think, I'll close with this, and I don't mean to be facetious when I say this. However, what has driven this, as I understand it, is the fact that Comcast bid on a job and won a job. And much to their chagrin, there were taxes, fees, and surcharges that went along with that job that they were not aware of. In my opinion, eliminating decades of well-working franchise fee law and eliminating that statute shouldn't be based on someone's failure to appropriately bid a job. That's just the cost of doing business, and you need to be aware of that when you bid on these kinds of jobs. I guess that's about all I have. I would ask you all and point out to you the fact that you don't need to find a bill with a relating clause. There's a fine bill on the other side of the house that we got this just perfectly well, and then that's been worked on for weeks and weeks and weeks. It's still over there, and it's over there for a reason. There are issues with this proposal. And I will tell you, I will commit to each one of you the same way I did over there. We will get at this during the interim. We will. And I think that's where I'll close. I'll be happy to answer any questions any of you might have.
Questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Verdi.
I expect I'll be seeing more of this in a different venue.
I certainly hope not.
Committee now.
But what I hear you saying is that you're open to at least having parity in terms of what services are subject to a franchise fee. For example, you know, their colored chart showed that, like, voicemail is subject to the fee if it's provided by Comcast, but not by landlines. And so I'm hearing you say that you're open to at least that part of what we're talking about. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, that is absolutely correct.
Mr. Chair, that's the part that interests me the most.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, if we... I mean, it's true. We have a 7% cap. They don't on those services. You know, you could say.
No, I think the point was that you don't get charged any franchise fee. You only get charged the 7% for the dial tone.
That's correct.
And for the rest, you don't get a franchise fee at all.
That's correct.
Whereas the cable companies get a franchise fee for all the services they
right.
provide.
And we are... Yes, we are happy to address that issue. We certainly are. We could tolerate a cap, a fee on those services, with a cap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And at this time, I would like to have Mr. Honeycutt come up so that he can explain. The other person wasn't a Honeycutt. Was a Honeyman. No. And to just express a couple of things, because I want to get us focused back to this other bill as we get back. And so that people know, I will talk to individual members and figure out if we want to add any of these other things to the bill. But I am really interested in the conversation that we had here with Senator Przanski about maybe approaching this a different way. And I'll meet with you, and we can figure that out later. But,
Mr. Chair, yes. I've got to catch somebody before they leave the building.
No problem. We're going to carry this bill over, so you'll be okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt again, just to correct a couple of points from the Dow's presentation. This can be and should or could be done through some amendments to the city's SDC ordinance. This is the improvements that they're talking about making would fall within an improvement fee under the statutory definition of a system development charge. And the benefit of doing it that way would be to spread more equitably the payment for the improvements that need to be made, rather than foisting the entire cost for the street improvements on a property owner who happens to own a large lot. The other way, as Senator Przanski suggested, would be to form the LID. You form the LID, you have some procedural protections for the property owners, and then the property owners can make an informed choice knowing the size of the district, the scope of the project, and their amount of the assessment. And they can also Bancroft bond and spread those assessments out over a period of time so that they're not being asked to pay the $80,000, whether it be at the time of the partition application or at the time of the issuance of the building permit. For the property owner, it doesn't really matter. It all is occurring up front. I know of no situation, and remember, this bill is limited to partitions. I know of no situations where a two-lot residential partition is going to generate $80,000 in improvements. Those improvements may need to be made in the city, but the better way to do that is through the SDC methodology, and then when there are specific instances that specially benefit a particular area through the formation of an LID. It's only the fee in lieu of the LID that gets us into trouble, and that really highlights how that, at least as it's being applied by the City of the Dalles, it doesn't really work here. The other thing we want to address, and I'll ask Randy to address this, is the payments. What happens with the payments if a person was to make a payment under the Dow's current ordinance? What would happen to that?
Chair Wilbon, committee members, It's been my understanding that we have no assurance that any funds collected under the circumstances that we're now living under.
Oh, make sure you do your name again. Our recording doesn't see you, so we need to know you. You need to put your name out when you before you start.
Randy Hager. Sorry about that. My understanding is that under the present circumstances, that any funds paid into a future local improvement district can go into the general fund, and that other projects in the city of the Dalles can then be funded by that money that's in the general fund. Example of that is work that was just done down in the industrial area, and I think that this was passed by city council maybe in December of 2012, when I believe $650,000 approximately was taken from that general fund and put into the local improvement district or the street fund where the city was improving in the industrial area. It's been my understanding that this has been a long-term practice of the city of the Dalles to transfer funds in and out of the general fund regardless of where they come from or what they were intended for. If there's anything else that I can clarify that, I'd try to do it, but I'm not really logged on to this issue because I've been working with this street improvement issues for 7 years, and the rest of it kind of went over there.
You know. We understand. Any further questions? And thank you for that, and I'll be getting a hold of you as we figure out where we're going to go.
Chair Roblin, I would like to answer a question that Senator Close had. May I do that?
Sure.
This will be quite brief. You asked about what did the money go to that I stated would be about $8,000. The property that I bought at 2804 East 10th Street was for sale, had some contingencies on it. Somebody else was trying to buy it. I came along. I had the money to buy it. And I received at the time of that sale papers which identified that the lot could be divided in, or the parcel could be divided into three lots, and that the total service development charges would be $264 for each lot, and that the main line extension for the sewer would be $2,500, and water connections and sewer connections and total service development charges to make those three lots, buildable lots, amounted to $8,292, and that was in 2002. I assumed that that was still my posture with that piece of property right up until the time that this sort of insidious idea about developing new ordinances came about. And then as late as November of 2012, when these ordinances were being put into check by the City Council directed staff to produce an ordinance which allowed for the partition of property to take place without that being a trigger to cause these enormous funds to be paid. And the staff proceeded to produce an ordinance which didn't include that non-trigger, sent it to the Land Use and Development, and came back to the Planning Commission, and the Planning Commission heard the issue April 4th of this year, and almost in a manner of some sort of argument between the staff and myself and a couple other neighbors, and determined that the way the ordinance had been changed from what the city council had asked for and what the staff was demanding was that the city or that the city planning commission denied accepting the ordinance and dictated that they take it back to city council for review and approval, leaving out the trigger that if you divided your land, you would have to pay the full fee. I hope that answers that question for you.
That clears it up. I misunderstood what you said.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you both. And for our last opportunity, Garrett, did you want to come back and say anything to wrap up here? Because I brought the other people back, and I always think that it's fair to, if there's anything you want to clarify with respect to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify two points. It's the policy in pretty much every Oregon community that we are familiar with that it is the property owner who gets the property up their street and other local improvements up to city standards, and then the city comes in and maintains those. That's pretty much every community we're familiar with. That's how it operates. So when we're doing these local improvements, that's what we are talking about, is getting a property into a habitable condition so that it has sewer and water and a street so that the property can be accessed for police and firefighter. That is a completely separate issue from a system development charge, which is the intended purpose is to deal with capacity issues at the sewer plant, at so that there's enough public parks. It's so that how you deal with that one person above the threshold that the system was designed for, how you deal with that extra charge so that you don't put it all on that 101st person for the 100 person system. So those were the only two points I wanted to clarify, and if okay. There's any further clarification.
The only thing with the streets is, in general, in the areas that I've been, there's two sides of the street, and I get paid to the middle, and the other person pays to the middle.
Yes.
Is that kind of what this does? I mean, or is it the whole street? Because these seem like really large numbers to me. They do. I mean, I'm just saying they seem like very large numbers. In any of those programs that I've been at where we've had to improve the road and all the communities come together and do it, it gets to be pretty big. But 20,000 is what I hear more often, and 30,000 for a couple lots than 80,000 or 50,000. That's
sure. Yep. Sure, Mr. Chair. We just like you stated, we assign responsibility for the frontage of the lot for the half of the street that they're on.
Okay.
Why those numbers are so large is that we have properties on the periphery of town that are 2 to 4 acres that can be a lot of frontage, and if they have nothing in place, no sewer, water, and you're looking at $351 a foot, if you got 800-900 feet of frontage like some of those properties have, that's how you get to those large numbers. But those are the outliers. Most properties are less than 200 feet within the city limits. And you can do the math quickly, but that's...
So, Garrett, I'm hearing this. I guess there's a couple things. Number one, if you have someone that has that large of an acreage and they just want to bring up their own house up to code, that would tell me that they would have to basically have the assessment for that. The rest of the property shouldn't be getting assessed. If it would or sometime get partitioned in the future, so be it. That's for whoever might be doing that. So that's the first point. Second point is that what I'm have a difficulty with is what we've heard is that we've got a system that's, as you said, the chicken or the egg, what comes first, who can do what. But even if they wanted to do this, in the sense of bring it forward, they're being held to a standard that they have to go through the city to do it, meaning they have to pay all these other costs as compared to if you said, if the city said, you can bring in your private contractor to do this work, and they just brought a line out, and then when the city came in and did the engineering, they would basically tie into it. But what I'm hearing is that they're taking the whole scope of what the project's going to be, how they're going to require, and where they want the piping to be for the sewer, for water, whatever it is. And it's a kind of a catch-22, not only for the city, but clearly for the individuals, to actually have to pay a much higher rate for the improvements that many are willing to pay if it wasn't costing what you would consider the general obligation of the community as a whole. But I also understand when you start annexing or bringing more property in, there are these other costs to be dealt with.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski. Going back to your first point about the size of the lot, under our proposed amendment, what happens is that they would sign a non-remonstrance agreement for the entire frontage, and when they developed, if they made three lots there and they're only developing lot A, they would only pay they would only be responsible for the frontage in front of that lot that's being vertically developed and adding to impact to our traffic system and all that. So that will do away with some of those large numbers that you're hearing, because right now it's all the whole frontage or don't pursue it. If that's how it currently works. So does that make sense?
Well, so some of these individuals have existing houses, dwellings on the property, and I'm assuming they need to come up to standard at this point.
We would like them to come up to standards, but there's no trigger for coming up to standard. Okay. If you currently have a dwelling on a substandard street, there's no trigger. Okay. The existing trigger is the LID, which we haven't done one in 16 years because they don't come together easily.
So if there was going to be a LID or fee charge in excess of whatever it was, they would be able to just bring their own current dwelling up to standard. Is that correct? I mean, they don't have to go through a partition to do this, in the sense of if they got as much acreage, they wanted to keep it as just their acreage and not develop it.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't they only be paying just for bringing the one dwelling that's existing up to standard? Or you're just saying because there's no trigger, they can stay there, they don't have to do anything?
Precisely. The only trigger to win
is if they want to do
is if they want to develop. And again, under our current system, if they want to partition, that is when they're faced with the question of, can I put it improvements myself? No, there's no engineering in place. Then I would make the payments in lieu. Under our proposal, they can make that partition, not incur any obligation to make those local improvements until they engage in some sort of vertical development, and then they would only their obligation would be for the frontage that is being developed, not the full frontage of the entire lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we are going to carry over House Bill 3479A to Tuesday. Yeah, or we can just carry it over each time. So let's just carry it over to Thursday. This coming Thursday. Yeah, which is the 23rd. Okay. That's the only one we have. So with that, we'll close our public hearing on House Bill 3479A. And I thank everybody for coming. And we're going to close the hearing, our committee meeting. So we are adjourned. Thanks for standing.